You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and you have the chance now, if it is still before the 3rd of July 2017, to take part in the discounted merch pre-sales. That's right, you can get the new ComCom t-shirt, brand new, white design on black, the fabulous horse sheriff's badge device by the official ComCom pod artist, Polly Becker. Do check them out at comedianscomedian.com/merch. And if it is before the 3rd of July, you can get a discount on those. So snap them up now. This is an episode recorded live at the O2 Arena, would you believe, as part of the Stone Free Festival. This is the excellent and lovely Ed Gamble.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the show, with all of the applause that the O2 Arena can muster, is Mr. Ed Gamble.
Hello. That was not bad.
That was not bad. They brought their A game.
Yeah. Well done, guys.
Ed, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I thought you would be the ideal booking for this, because you're a badass Slayer fan with tattoos.
I am. This is not really a sort of Slayer sort of festival, though. This is more dad rock, is how I'd put it. More Marks and Spencer's jeans than you'd see at a Slayer gig.
That is definitely true. I mean, there was a lot of parents in that queue coming in. I mean, I this is going to sound terrible. I can't name anything by Rainbow.
Since you've been gone, mate.
Oh, was that them?
Yeah,
can you name anything else?
No.
Okay, fine.
I mean, they do have to call it Richie Blackmore's Rainbow, just in case people think it might be Zippy and Bungle turning up.
Zing. And you told me earlier on, this is the second time you've been in this venue this week.
Second time I've been at I was in the Indigo on Monday, emceeing the Metal Hammer Magazine Golden God Awards.
That sounds like the best corporate gig in the world.
Well, I mean, it was not paid like a corporate gig.
Okay.
I did it because the guy who normally does it just wanted to get pissed and watch. But it was probably the most exciting night of my life.
Go on.
I was introducing two of my favourite bands of all time the stage, Clutch and Mastodon.
Clutch!
Yeah.
I don't know much about Mastodon, but I'm a new convert to Clutch.
Yeah, they're amazing, and I got to introduce them onto the stage.
Oh, man. And did you meet them and hang out with them and touch their butts?
I refused to meet them.
Really?
Not actively. I didn't actively refuse. Like, someone said, you Clutch really want to meet you, man. No way. No, I just didn't want to meet them, because what's going to come out of that? I was going, I really love you guys.
I am good friends with Sophie Aldred, who used to play Ace on Doctor Who, which I think will be before your time, but there will be a certain slice. The audience member over there, the audience member, that's blown the gaff. The gentleman in the front row there, the gentleman who is 50% of the front row, is nodding excitedly. Yeah, Sophie Aldred. So she used to play the official hottest ever Doctor Who companion.
Right.
When I was a kid, she was hot stuff.
And you're friends with her now.
And now I'm mates with her, because I know her husband really well. He's a street performer. So, take a drink now. So, I was at, I can't remember what function it was, but a friend of mine called Dave was at this thing with us, and I said, do you want to meet Sophie? And he went, yeah, no. And he properly freaked out. So you had a similar thing with Clutch. You thought you would be...
Yeah, because the only scenario that exists in my head is I meet Clutch and then they ask me to be in the band.
Yes.
And I know that's not going to happen. So I was happy to stand backstage with them and watch other bands and be next to the drummer while he was sat on his practice kit practicing. That was very exciting for me.
That's nice.
That's all I needed. And I got to meet Chris Jericho, the wrestler, and I got to meet Chuck D from Public Enemy. So
this is incredible. Now, this leads nicely into what I've now decided is going to be my first question. Do you feel within comedy that you have everything you want? I think from the outside, you seem to be one of those people who has a kind of... I don't quite mean like a charmed life. I'm not suggesting that there hasn't been a lot of hard work and stuff and a lot of exciting weight loss, which we'll discuss later. But I think you are one of those people who gets to live the role of a comedian and you just get all your dreams come true. You get to meet exciting people.
That was exciting.
Travel all over the world. You know, do you feel like comedy is giving you everything you want?
No, I do not feel like that at all. I don't think anyone feels that they lead a charmed life. I'm willing to admit that I've been pretty lucky, and I've had a lot of other people help me and sort of take me under their wing throughout my career, which has been very nice. But I'm certainly not like completely satisfied. I don't think anyone is. I think you just stop working if you're satisfied, don't you?
What's the thing that you don't currently have that most rankles that you don't have it?
Another 20 minutes for my Edinburgh show?
Well, God, let's take that as absolute standard. Speaking as, and it's not often that I have people on the podcast who, you know, we have sat together in, I nearly named one of our secret writing locations, but we've sat together in a few places and hammered out ideas and tried, you know, kind of explored angles and stuff like that. We'll get onto the technical writing stuff in a bit. But everyone needs 20 minutes for their Edinburgh show.
Yes.
As Alan Cochrane always says, always the sentence what does he say, the sentence I need three more good bits is always true and will be for the rest of your life.
I mean, that makes me feel that Edinburgh show should be 40 minutes long.
They 100% should be. This is a movement I'm going to start on the podcast. They're 45 and then you've got a 15 minute changeover and it's the next one. Everyone starts on the hour. It's easy and you just get the good stuff. You'd get as good a show. You just get less flanneling. And I mean, the band have stopped warming up, but now someone is kicking an ice machine to death.
It's good atmosphere.
So, given that you definitely need 20 more minutes, what else do you want that you don't have? What sorts of things are we talking about?
I think I'm definitely on the path that I would like to be. I just want more of it, Stu. Just want, you know, more people to come and see me, bigger audiences, you know, bigger tour venues, all of that sort of stuff. I think I just want to keep going in this direction. And I don't necessarily feel like I've completely found all of the stuff that I want to talk about yet.
Okay.
I'm not digging into anything important yet.
Do you mean important as in important in the world socially, politically, or do you mean important as in important stuff in your life?
Important stuff in my life. I think I've sort of let go of any notion that I could be a socially or politically important comedian. It's just not. I've spent a while going like, well, maybe I should just start trying to think about something like that. And then I think eventually you just come to the conclusion that it's just not me.
That is an interesting feeling. I remember leaving my actor's agent. I was a fraudulent actor for a few years before I became a comic. And when I eventually left the acting agent that I had struggled so hard for years to sign with, I walked out of that door thinking, I'm a comedian now.
Yeah.
And, oh, God. So it must be a similar feeling of like, I'm just not political.
Yeah.
Well, hey.
It's just, I think... I don't know what it is. I think it's if you do Edinburgh a lot, there's certainly a trend at the moment for the critically lauded stuff to be the shows that are saying something socially or politically, which is great and they're amazing shows. But you can't try and bend what you're doing towards that. It's like music. Like I wouldn't necessarily come and see Rainbow, but they're very good. They're very good at what they do. I think.
Are you saying that as if someone from Rainbow has walked into
Is Richie
room.
Blackmore in? I love your stuff, man.
So for people who don't know you, what kind of subjects do you talk about?
I talk about myself a lot. A lot of people have accused me of being self-deprecating, but I don't think of it like that. I just think of absolutely telling the truth about myself. I talk about myself and my home life and... like weight loss, you said that was a big thing for a couple of years that I talked about. It's mainly about myself.
Okay, just for people who don't know you, explain the weight loss thing.
I lost six stone in about a year.
And this is not a 20 stone man saying that. This is not like that was like half your body weight.
I was 19 stone, and I lost 6 stone. That took up a large part of my first show, second show, and partially my third show.
Do you feel you Because I saw some of those shows, and you've got some brilliant stuff about it. That thing about the belt buckle.
Yeah, that was first show.
You've got it. Was that your first show?
That was first show.
So yeah. You had a routine about your. You had an eagle belt buckle, which you bought because you suddenly could buy cool clothes because now you'd lost all this weight and you believed in yourself more. And it made two little points when you bent over, so it looked like your nether regions were in inverted commas.
Yes.
I'm going from memory here. I believe also you said that because you dressed slightly to the left, it looked like your dick was in italics.
In italics, yeah, that's it. You've remembered more than me. I'd forgotten
about that. That's very good.
I might bring that bit back.
Yeah. We'll get on to one of the things I want to talk about is your ability. I think you've got a really strong ability to continue mining stuff, you know, in that way that Matt Kirshen is really good at. And a tag, and another tag,
tag. Yeah.
I think that's a speciality of yours. But you talked about the weight loss. Do you, and you kind of said there, well, in my first show, my second show, some my third show. Do you feel you overdid that? If I was you, I would have thought, hey, this is an angle.
Yeah.
I've got a thing to say
because
actually I'm a nice middle-class white boy.
Yeah. I think I only realized that after the second show.
Okay.
Which was very frustrating because I kept coming up with new bits about losing weight. And then eventually looked at it all and went, that would have been a really good 55-minute show.
Yes.
But unfortunately, it was spread out across three shows. And I think when I was doing my first show, I was not confident enough to make it all about one thing. I think I just wanted to do that thing of just collecting everything that I'd written so far. Because I'd been doing comedy for 7 years before I did my first show. So I had all this stuff, and I was like, well, just ram it into the hour and just hope it all fits together. Whereas now, I think only now am I approaching a level of confidence as a comic where I could just go like, people will come and watch me talk about one thing for 50 minutes.
It's weird. I find myself I try not to give advice, but I am asked very frequently because the idea of having a podcast apparently means that I'm good. And in the eyes of nice people that listen to the podcast. But the advice, I'm trying to be self-deprecating about the fact I do give people advice. I hate the idea of giving people advice. And often the advice that I give people is don't listen to anyone's advice.
Right.
But the one other thing I will often say to newer acts is, if they're stressing about their competition set, there's no such thing as competitions, there's no such thing as the industry. But if they're stressing about their set, the thing I try to say is, do 7 minutes about one subject.
Yeah.
Because that does display, maturity or experience? Or like, I certainly, when I did my competition sets, I got the five funniest bits I had and rammed them all together and tried to take all the gaps out and all the pauses and all everything. But there is something to be said for going, nope, I'm talking about this. And I think people really respect that.
I think it shows confidence and like brass balls that early on in a career to be like, I'm going to mine one subject for 7 minutes. And some of it might not be funny, but we're getting somewhere with it.
And what was the reception to your first show?
Fine. Like, absolutely fine. But with Edinburgh, like, critically, that's my bag. Absolutely fine.
Is it?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Like, certainly my first show, which... I don't know, maybe that's unfair. Certainly my first show, I've been going for 7 years. Everyone had seen me. They'd seen most of the bits. They knew what I did. And then I just did that. So I wasn't like showing up going like, you've seen that. Come and watch me. I've been to Goliath. I'm going to do my clown show. It was just, I was just doing what I'd been doing, which I think worked to get a new audience in and to sort of progress my career. But critically, no one's going like, oh my God, have you seen what Gamble's doing this year? It's what we've seen him do already.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you regret that? Do you feel like you could have made more of an impact by pushing yourself harder?
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, certainly. But I think we can all say that. I was very happy with all the stuff in it, and it's meant that I am where I am now because it was just like I've just kept writing stand up.
So talk about where you are now. How do you feel about where you are now? Because I've got my preconceptions about where you are now.
Yeah.
I feel like you're in the ascendancy. You've been on Mock the Week a good few times now.
Yeah.
You're kind of lifting. Like, if you look at your tour schedule, they're it's a decent length tour. They're decent sized rooms. It's like, oh, Gamble's achieving escape velocity.
You say that, but they just let you book those rooms. It doesn't mean that anyone's going to come. You can just book them and put them on a poster.
Feel like you've disavowed the idea of self-deprecating earlier
on.
Doing fine in those rooms.
Yes, doing fine in those rooms. It does feel like things are going in the right direction. It's taken quite a long time sort of chipping away at it, but it certainly feels like doing things like Mock the Week, and then, you know, that hopefully leading to other stuff and selling tickets and people seem more interested. It feels like it's going in the right direction.
What the listener at home might not hear is that someone has just started playing a guitar solo in the background, and it was just such a perfect filmic moment of like, yeah. It feels like it's going in the right direction. Great. So it's clearly going in the right direction. Do you know what I mean by escape velocity? That kind of like, we're all on the circuit, we're all chipping away.
Yeah.
And then you go, hang on a minute, they're doing quite well, because then as soon as you become a TV face,
yeah,
you start getting booked for other TV things.
Well, yeah, you'd hope so, yeah.
Do you feel that happening?
Yeah, I'm certainly busier, but I will also do anything.
What sort of things?
Oh, just whatever you throw at me. I don't care what channel it's for. I don't care what I have to do. I'll just do it. It's all about, these days, it's all about just getting your face out there, even if it is covered in custard on ITV2.
Well, the first thing in which I remember you getting your... We'll talk about the double act in a minute as well. But the first thing where I thought, oh, hang on, Gamble's going off, was Almost Royal.
Yeah.
So you did it. Could you just tell us what that show was? Because I watched a little bit of it again in researching for this interview, and it's very, very funny.
Oh, thank you, man.
It's much funnier than I expected it to be, given that it's kind of Sunday morning hangover fare.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it was quite gentle. I'll explain what it was. It was a BBC American show, so it was an American commissioned show, but co-produced with a British production company called Burning Bright. And it was me and Amy Hoggart pretending to be 50th and 51st in Lines of the Throne and filming a documentary across the States, meeting real people and sort of acting like we were, you know, trying to find out more about America as British royalty. So it's sort of a Borat type thing, but what we always wanted was for it to be more gentle than Borat. It was always us looking like idiots.
Yes.
And people going, God, these...
It's not about trying to highlight people's prejudices or ignorance or whatever. It was actually just an opportunity for you to push improvising and how stupid you could be.
Very early on, I remember doing the pilot thinking, oh, we can really highlight some social stuff here. And talking to a man, we were in the middle of Tennessee somewhere. And he was driving us out into a lake to catch catfish with our hands. I remember saying things to him, like trying to catch him in traps to say something racist. And he just wasn't. He just wasn't racist. I was like, I'll probably just leave that then. It feels cruel.
Is it fair to say you would not have got that role without the radical weight loss?
No, I definitely wouldn't have got it, no.
Because you turned out as a young fat man.
Yeah.
Did you even know you had the incredible bone structure that you have?
Well, that's very nice of you, Stu. I didn't realise I would look as royal as I did underneath. And I look a lot younger underneath all the fat than I was expecting. I think there's some sort of preservation thing. It's just, it's like the amber in Jurassic Park has just preserved my age.
So when you were, did you... If I try and imagine myself what it must be like to do those kind of, like, improvising, having to be funny, under a certain amount of pressure, having to not tip the wink, having to be outrageous and stupid such that it would be funny, but not so much so that your guest goes, well, this is clearly bullshit.
Yeah.
Talk to us about that kind of tightrope. Did it make you tense? Was it worrying, or was it something you just took to naturally?
Certainly. I mean, we filmed so much for it. Like, we probably filmed three times more than was actually ever on the screen. So the initial ones where you go into it, it's quite tense and can be a bit stilted, and you don't know when to get in a stupid line. And eventually you learn that sometimes you can be in there for 3 hours, and the first 2 hours, 50 minutes, just you need to be quite normal. So they're completely bought into you, and then the last 10 minutes is an absolute ridiculous storm of stupid lines.
Do you have anything that you regard as kind of like the bit you enjoyed most, the stupidity that you enjoyed most?
Oh, there's so much. There's something in the second season where we went to like a space center and did like a simulation of landing a space station. So there's loads of people from the space center in there teaching us how to do it. And then like something went wrong and we had to solve a puzzle to get it all back online again. And the stuff we were coming out with, at one point Amy got her high heel stuck in the thing, so we couldn't get the oxygen back online, and one of them was pretending that he couldn't breathe. And obviously it's normally like kids doing this, and they do it so quickly that he doesn't need to pretend that he's dying. They're going, he's dying, he's dying. She's going, I can't get my shoe out of the mat. And I said something, referred to an anus as a back nostril. I was very proud of that.
Were there times as well when it went wrong?
We got called on it twice.
Only twice in two seasons.
I think quite often, probably what happened was the people we were meeting clocked that something was going on that was not how it was originally presented, and either they were a bit afraid if they called us out on it and it wasn't a setup, then they'd look embarrassed in front of loads of cameras, or they just played along with it because they thought it was funny. Because, like, okay. I say, we weren't making fools out of them. It was just us saying stupid stuff. So if I was on their side, I'd just be like, well, this is clearly fake, but it's very funny. Let's keep going with
yes,
it.
Yes, okay.
So we were called on it twice, once by a shaman in the Hollywood Hills, but we went too far. That was an example of us going too far too soon.
What did you do?
Well, we'd watch videos of him and his method. There's a video of him online. He's also Gwyneth Paltrow shaman. He was in the Evening Standard recently. His name's
Oh, yeah, I know that guy.
Shaman Durek. He's an absolute shyster. Online, there's a video of him like getting people to close their eyes and do this breathing, and he goes, I'm going to pull the poison out of you. I'm going to pull the poison out of you. So I thought it would be funny. I didn't ask production. I thought it would be funny if I drank 2 litres of Pepsi Max before, and then when he said, I'm going to pull the poison out of you, I just did a really big fart, which is too far. It's too far, because that was in the first 10 minutes, because I'd drunk the Pepsi Max. I'd mistimed my Pepsi Max drinking. And I let rip, and he went, okay, this is a joke, immediately after the fart, because Amy burst out laughing.
Oh, wow. I mean, that is quite telling, isn't it, that the one person or one of the two people who spotted you are people who themselves trick people.
Exactly, exactly. And the other person who spotted us in season two, we interviewed some celebrities, and it was Lisa Vanderpump, who has a reality show called Vanderpump Rules. And she's British, and she spotted it.
Yeah, okay.
Because she said something about having a TV, and we said, oh, no, we don't have a TV. I just like to look out the window at all the lovely grass, or something like that. And she went, okay, this is a joke. No British person doesn't have a TV.
Yeah,
busted. And then she said she knew Earl Spencer, and she was going to call him to check.
That's nice.
Yeah.
That's nice. So did you... The impression I got at the time was when I saw that show on TV, I was like, oh, hang on a minute. And America, that's now, I know you've done Conan. We'll maybe come back to that. But there is, I thought to myself, that's probably the sort of experience that as a comedian would make you go, hang on a minute, I am real. Like it would put to bed any kind of, like the self-doubting voices. You go, I've just been funny on TV for 2 seasons. I'm getting laughs in the room, I'm getting laughs from Amy, it's all working. Was that kind of an environment whereby, and I was just about to refer to the music, was that an environment whereby you came out of that experience, I mean, did that quell any dissenting voices in your head about your own sense of legitimacy as a comic?
I think it does for a bit. I don't know how you feel about these sorts of things, but certainly the way I feel is every achievement I have for about a day, I'll be like, hang on, this is going all right, I've managed to do that, I might be all right, and then that becomes normal, and then you're like, right, what's next, because this isn't good enough anymore. I will only dwell on feeling good about an achievement for max 48 hours.
So this is Ed. Great fun talking to him. We'll get straight back to the interview in just a second. I've got a listener email here from Stephen in the US. He says, I really appreciate your approach to interviewing, but as someone who lives on the west coast of America, there's very little chance I'll be coming to any shows in the UK. It kind of twists the dagger when you say something like, buy a ticket, come to the show. It's just a little cruel for those of us listeners living outside the UK. Thanks for the great podcasts. Well, he says, anyway, thanks for the great podcast. I abbreviated that, and it was not successful. Stephen, thank you very much. I love the way you're changing the phrase twist the knife to twist the dagger. That's pretty arcane. Well done. If there's enough of you in America, there's a few ComCom listeners in America. There's a good few of you. But really, to be worth the whatever it is, $3,500 on the working visa, we need to really big up that kind of groundswell of opinion. So thank you very much for listening. And I hope if you are listening to this in America, whether you are Stephen or someone else, if you could pop along to the iTunes page, if that's how you do your podcasts, and just leave me a pleasant review, because the reviews, as I've mentioned before on the show, are specific to country, so it really helps make the podcast more visible in your lands if you give us a little review there. Thank you very much, though.
I'm very pleased you're listening, Stephen. Someone called Chelsea donated, but I couldn't reply because her email keeps bouncing. Sorry, Chelsea. I've tried to send that reply numerous times. If you would like to support the podcast and hopefully receive an actual personal reply from me, then you can do that at comedianscomedian.com/donate. You can do it with a recurring monthly payment via PayPal or Moonclerk. What's one of them? Who knows? You'll have to find out. Or you can do a one-off payment as well, or just see me in person and press some cash into my hand. I'm going to be at Glastonbury, so if you're around the Glastonbury Festival, you can come along and see me. I'm hosting the cabaret tent, which is basically the comedy tent, same thing. I'm also doing a set there, so hosting on the Friday afternoon, doing a set, I believe, on the Saturday. But check those lovely big boards. And if it's raining, I shall be hiding inside a double-decker bus. Hurrah! So apologies to Chelsea, but if you would like to donate, you could do that. You know how to do it. If you want to go to comedianscomedian.com/merch, you can support the show in a way that means you get a thing. So do, even if you're not going to buy one, just check out the design. I'm so excited about them. Polly's done a brilliant job there. And the pre-sales are now on until the 3rd of July, so you can get a bit of a discount if you order up quick. Not long to go till Edinburgh. My guest, the brilliant Ed Gamble, is going to be there. He will be there with his new show, Mammoth. I forget the venue. Maybe we talked about it in this episode, but I know that you can Google it up, a treat. So do go along to see that if you can. And of course, if you're at the Edinburgh Festival, come along and see my show, Like I Mean It, proud winner of the 2017 Best New Show Award at Leicester Comedy Festival, about which I shall stop banging fairly soon. But the Hell Week previews were great. If you came along to them, I really enjoyed them. They're just, it's a really new sort of a thing for me this year. It's kind of even, it's sort of dafter and lighter. There's a bit about howling. Is that light? Yeah, maybe it is. Maybe it is. I think I do a light touch. So thank you to everyone that came along to Hell Week. And thank you especially to Kate Webster, who is becoming not just a com completist, but also sort of a Goldsmith completist as well. It's quite impressive. She's seen practically all. Kate, you must have seen something like 7 previews. I mean, it's too many previews, but your feedback is always greatly appreciated. So that is that. Edinburgh, of course, 3:45 in the Liquid Rooms. And I will chat to you more after the episode with a little postamble. So now back to Ed Gamble.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
It's interesting. I get glimmers of this from you, just sort of in our friendship as well as from your work on stage, whereby you are very outwardly happy and positive and confident. And Every so often you'll say something and I'll think, are you a twisted up little crazy pretzel in your head?
I definitely am.
Because I know you're like, the term OCD is bandied around, but you're like obsessively tidy.
I am, but I've had to let that go since moving in with my girlfriend. I've had to actively relax. So I think OCD is probably too strong a term for it.
So what is the broader picture then of what's going on inside your head?
That's a very vague question, Stu.
It's designed to be.
See, it's so tricksy. I think that's an interesting thing. Like I'm quite tidy. I get flustered. I was flustered on the way here because I thought I was going to be late. It's too warm. It's too sweaty. I was just gripping the side of the rail replacement bus. I was about to have a full meltdown. People who don't know me very well think I am very very relaxed and very happy in my career. Whereas I am, you know, on the whole, pretty happy. But I have the odd day of lack of confidence and thinking I'm doing things wrong. Sure. I think that's normal. I hate anyone who's just like, yeah, I'm loving it, man. I'm so laid back.
I'm just trying to get a sense of whether you have a normal, well-adjusted, occasional bad days or whether there is like a kind of screaming skull guy on the inside.
I don't, probably not a screaming skull day. I think it's probably quite normal down days where you suddenly go, oh, God. Am I doing this right?
And what sorts of things is it for you that triggers those those kind of feelings, like with that sense of, like, because I get the impression, well, let's talk a little bit about how you started and what your background was, because you went to a nice school.
Yes.
And you went to Durham.
Yes.
Where you were buddies with Nish Kumar. I've got a listener question from Nish coming up later on. As you can imagine, it's about butts.
I was in a sketch group with Nish Kumar and Tom Neenan.
Were you?
I was.
I didn't know about that. Yeah. This is pre-Gentleman of Leisure.
This is pre-Gentleman of Leisure. This was the Durham Review.
Okay.
So I was in the Durham Review as soon as I arrived at Durham. I auditioned for them, got in. And then the year after that, Tom and Nish both auditioned and I let them in.
Nice.
And then the rest is history.
And you did a romantic novelist character called Selsdon Krupp.
I did. Most successful thing I've ever done. Only time I reached a competition final. Chortle Student Comedian of the Year competition. I was a romantic novelist character. It was sort of basically all my favourite bits from Garth Marenghi, Alan Partridge in The Office, all fused together into one character. But it was a lot of just like parodies of romantic fiction.
Okay.
Quite funny.
But you did that, were you already doing stand-up by the time you did that?
I did sketch stuff. My first gig was just as myself, and that was a So You Think You're Funny heat. In 2005, then I got through to the semi-final.
And, who knocked you out?
Kevin Bridges.
Ah, there we go. Yeah, that's respectable.
All right, isn't it?
There we
go. I got through to the semi-final, and there was about, I think probably about 6 months, was there? Oh no, maybe less than that. Maybe 3 months between the heat and the semi-final. And this shows how green I was. At no point did I think, maybe I should do another practice gig in between. I just thought, looks like the semi-final's my second gig.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that was your first ever gig?
My first ever gig was the heat. Second ever gig was the semi-final.
Incredible.
And then my third gig was the Samsung student competition at Leeds Jonglers, where it wasn't like a competition night. You just went on in the middle. Two acts went on in the middle of a normal Jonglers night. And I never died harder than that. That is absolutely the worst 6 minutes of my life.
I'm trying to imagine a fresh-faced young Ed Gamble in the middle at Leeds Jonglers.
Yeah.
In a student competition where they're, please welcome student.
Yeah, and
Ed
they
Gamble.
Didn't know it was happening. So they just brought me on and I did I had a big pad and I did a bit about a conspiracy theory about a Daz washing powder being owned by the Ku Klux Klan.
Where did the... That was presumably not in your competition set.
No, I don't think it was in the first two gigs. I was writing pretty fresh. But I did brand new stuff in the semi-final of So You Think You're Funny. I just did, because I thought you just had to sort of write a new set for every gig, really.
Okay. So who were you going into that? Like, was that... I mean, let me just get the timeline right. Was it Durham Review and then that bit of stand-up?
Yeah, so Durham Review in 2005, then the So You Think You're Funny stuff in 2005, and then continued doing sketch stuff. Started a stand-up night in Durham in 2006, where I gave Nish Kumar his first ever gig.
You're a legend.
And I had dinner with Nish and his parents yesterday, and they actively blame me for Nish being a comedian.
That's only fair.
Yeah.
Nish, at my wedding last weekend, made a point of meeting both of my parents and hanging out with them, and both of them have since told me what a lovely man he is.
He's so nice.
So you're... The beginnings of the comedian Ed Gamble when you were a kid, were you fat as a kid?
Yeah, always.
Or did you, I couldn't tell. Were you like university fat? Were you like, off the chain, pizza time?
I was fat going into university, and then I was off the chain. I didn't realise I was chained. And then I got to university and I was like, it's pizza time now.
Okay.
So it was fat on fat.
And were you a funny kid?
Yeah, I'd say so. I was brilliant, mate.
Rare that people say that with such confidence.
I think
confidence.
I was. Cheeky.
Okay.
A cheeky kid.
You're a good with mums guy.
Yeah, I'm good with mums because I'm funny with mums, but not in a blue way. Sometimes blue, but I know when to drop a bit of blue in with the mums.
Was comedy ever something that seemed to you like an impossible dream, or did it seem like a perfectly reasonable option?
Absolutely, just stumbled into it. At no point did I think it would be a career option. Once I start thinking of things like, well, if I do this, this, and this, then this will happen. Then I get too stressed out and I feel it's slightly too pressurized. So it sort of worked out pretty well for me in that I just started doing it because it was fun and then just kept doing it. That's what it feels like.
So is that what you attribute your success to, is resilience more so than a game plan or skill?
Never, ever had a game plan. Never. Just always just blundering through. I still feel like that. But that works. That totally works for me. Because otherwise, I don't know, I think I just get, if I start thinking, if this goes well, then this will happen, I overpressurize myself and I fall to pieces. I have to, saying this to someone the other day, actually, even when it comes down to individual gigs, I have to actively not care how it goes or whether the audience enjoy it to have a good gig.
That is fascinating. Talk to me more about that.
It's not a disrespect for the audience. I want them to have a nice time, but in my own head, I just have to be like, oh, so if it doesn't go well, who cares?
Is that a similar thing to that kind of... I remember talking to Arnab Chanda.
Yeah.
Brilliant comedian. Yeah. I'm not 100%. I think he's... Is he still doing production stuff? He was being a producer for a while, making films. Very talented man.
Very.
But I remember him saying, he just seemed so bulletproof on stage 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And I said, where do you get that kind of confidence from? And he said, it comes from bombing a lot. You know, there's that kind of like that American influence of just going, you'd go on stage, you die, and you just become completely death-proof.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't matter to you. Is that what you're talking about, or is that something different?
No, I think it's something different. I think if I start worrying how a gig's going to go and thinking in my head, this has to go well, then I don't fall apart, but it's just too stilted. I need to be super loose and super not caring about the gig. Like I need to look like I've just sort of wandered on. Otherwise I get too, like, that's the same with the writing. If it's too structured and too like this joke, I'll just go and bark it at them and there's no connection, there's no feeling that it's even a live performance. I'll just do it. It's too stilted.
And yet when you do stand up on TV, like on your Conan set, mm-hmm. presumably that is a very rigorous, submitted kind of a script. So talk to me about the difference in, like, how do you maintain that feeling of looseness, and particularly knowing that that's like, it, you have to have that to make it work in an environment where you absolutely can't be loose. How do you achieve that?
Well, sometimes I don't achieve it. So I think that Conan clip's...
Great answer.
I think that Conan clip's all right. I very rarely watch myself back because I just find myself very annoying. So I wouldn't watch myself back. But I think I've seen the Conan clip, and that's okay because I'm clearly so excited to be there and it's such a different environment. And the audience are the most up for it audience for anything in the entire world. Like, they're whooped up. And they've just seen, you know, Antonio Banderas being interviewed. They're very excited. The warm-up guy does an amazing job. So I'm just elated to be there, which sort of relaxed me a little bit.
Okay.
But I think you could probably watch me on a couple of other TV things, early TV things, where I'm clearly a bit like, this has got to go well. And it's just not loose enough. It's not fun enough.
So one of the loosest things I've ever seen you do is the double act, Peacock and Gamble.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about that. I watched, I remember you suggested watching your Russell Howard's Good News clip, which you described as not necessarily our finest hour.
No, I don't think it was. I think our finest hours were always just in little rooms in Edinburgh where everything got massively off track.
So describe the double act for people who've not seen it.
Well, the double act came from a podcast that we did together. So originally...
Before podcasting was cool.
Before podcasting was cool. Ian Boldsworth, then Ray Peacock, decided to do a podcast. He'd invited some people to do it with him. One of the guys he was doing it with dropped out. And we'd met in 2005 when he came to Compare a Durham Review Show. And he just said, do you want to come and do an episode? And it went pretty well, so he just asked me to be on it. And then eventually the other guy left, and then so we started doing the Peacock and Gamble podcast. So it always came from a completely improvised conversation. We'd have some sections that we would do week to week, but it was always completely improvised. And then when we decided to do the double act, we would write it, but he is a liability for going off script. So the way that the dynamic ended up working was him always trying to come away from the script and me desperately trying to get everything back on track.
That's interesting because I saw the show live as well, and I remember that aspect to it, and I didn't know how much of that was the kind of the contrivance of a double act and how much of it was real and how much of it had used to be that and was now the contrivance of a double act.
Yeah, well, so I think it's probably a mix because there was certainly, he would always come off script at least once and start doing something, but he would just be testing to see what worked. And then if it really worked, we'd do the same thing the next night, but eventually we'd just end up building shows from him misbehaving and me trying to get him back on track.
And does that, there is an element to which you are perpetually telling him off,
yes,
complaining about what he does.
Yeah.
And he, I mean, he does some unbelievably childish,
it's
like
ridiculous.
Even on the Russell Howard clip, there's just sort of a joke out of nowhere where he just starts trying to fist you.
And you know, yeah, but so that, I'm not sure if that was a joke that he'd ever done before.
Yeah, that's the impression I got, because from your reaction,
on
you really
TV
look like,
as well.
What are you doing during this TV set?
That's how we kept it, we kept that loose. I mean, also the Russell Howard set, he comes on wearing my actual hat that I'd come to the studio in. He'd never worn that hat before, and we'd run on and I just had to take the hat off him. I don't know what he was thinking was going to happen. Suddenly we were going to come up with a routine about a hat, but that sort of, that sums up how it was. Like, he's a complete, very, I mean, the funniest person I've ever worked with, an absolute loose cannon.
And that seems to have quite a sort of an enjoyable amount of friction with you as this sort of
definitely
tense,
yeah,
worried, tidy freak.
Definitely based in reality, the dynamic. And also very funny because he is the older one.
How much older than you is he?
I don't know how he's in his 40s now, I guess. So probably he's like 12 or 13 years older than me.
Because I remember thinking that's quite unusual in double acts. I think of,
yeah,
like, I don't know if you ever saw No Son of Mine.
I didn't.
Oh, they were fantastic. More on that later. But which is what I say when I can't remember the names, yeah, of the people involved. It was great, and I can't remember the names of the guys involved. It was so good. But yeah, that idea of having a, when you say people took you under their wing.
Yeah, so he was the first, definitely, who sort of, I guess, saw that I was funny or whatever and was doing this podcast and very kindly went, do you want to come and do an episode? And it worked out pretty well. And like, I'm with the same manager as he is now. So certainly meeting him and doing stuff with him was the first little boost. And just an example of me blundering my way through again. I just met someone, we got on, he went, oh, I've got this manager, do you want to meet him? I was like, yeah, fine, whatever.
Do you imagine if that hadn't happened, would you have pushed through and got that management anyway, or some sort of management anyway? Are you a sort of an internally driven kind of a person? Because I don't know, like, you present yourself as this kind of bumbling through person. Yeah,
yeah,
sure, you've had luck,
yeah,
but you've also been very hardworking and resilient,
yeah,
and you're tense enough to make yourself.
Yeah, I've probably been a little bit unfair. I'm not, it's not all blunder. I'm sure that certainly with the management that we're both with, we booked him for that gig, and I looked at who they had on their stable at the time. I was like, they'd
yeah,
be good to be represented by. So something went on in my head.
Okay.
And then I found myself going towards them. But it wasn't like an active, like, okay, I'm going to write down my plans for a career and put them on the wall with pins and string.
So in your relationship with Ian, mm-hmm, in your working relationship with him, was there an extent to which, given that he was much older and much more experienced,
yeah,
as a comic, was it an equal partnership creatively?
No, he definitely shapes it more than I did, I think.
And how did that feel at the time? Were you happy to be kind of,
yeah,
carried along with it?
Absolutely fine with that. Because, like I say, very, very funny. I mean, I had a big hand in it as well, but he's one of the most driven people I've met, and super confident in, I've come up with this idea, here's the end point of the idea, I am now going to do everything I can to make that idea happen as quickly as possible. So he's like, he just gets something between his teeth and he just runs with it, which is quite useful for me, because quite often what I'll do is I'll have an idea what the end product in is, start working towards that idea, lose confidence halfway through, put it in a drawer, and then come back to it about 3 years later. That tends to be with what happens with me.
So I'm just trying to think if there was another thing. In the Peacock and Gamble section was about Naughty Keith.
Naughty Keith was our ventriloquist puppet.
A sort of horrifying bondage muppet.
Yeah, it was made out of a bin bag and a popped football with bike-like eyes. And it had a really red mouth. It was absolutely horrifying. And he just squawked. His catchphrase was piss.
His catchphrase was just
shouting the word piss. We did that at Comedy for Kids once. Not the. I mean, I don't think he ever said piss. But we got a kid out of the audience to control Naughty Keith for himself, and the kid went mad and just started biting us.
It's no more than you deserve.
Yeah, very true.
So did you... What did you take from you in terms of your... Well, A, what did your parents think?
My dad never fully understood Peacock and Gamble as a thing, I think. And he came to see us in Edinburgh where we had the best show we ever had. And to this day, I've never had a better show as a solo performer in the double act. It was ridiculous. You know those shows where you get about 20 minutes in and you're like, what is wrong with you people?
Yeah.
I don't even like it this much.
Yeah.
My dad just looked baffled. Like, he came out and he was just like, he's got no idea what it was. I think he prefers me solo because at least he can sort of, you know, I tell a funny story. And he's like, yeah, that is a funny story. And it's not people running around with a bin bag on their hand shouting piss. But it's still supportive, still very supportive. It's like, that's what you want to do? Absolutely. And the same, my mum, if she was baffled by anything, she would not show it. She feels very nervous coming to watch me do stand-up. Just the idea that I might do badly and she'll have to be there. And was also, similarly, my dad was at my best ever show. My mum was at my biggest death of all time in Edinburgh in 2014.
Let's talk about your worst death ever.
I mean, it was my solo show, my first solo show. It was pure silence for 55 minutes.
What room were you in?
The Pleasance This.
I don't think I saw that one. What was...
You did, because you're my albatross. Every time you see me in Edinburgh, it's been a bad show.
That's not true. Well, Lawman, I saw a good Lawman.
That was... Lawman was a good... I mean, that was a blessed year for the time and the room, so it was pretty good all the way through, apart from the one you came to, which was a little bit sticky.
Okay, fine.
So it was all right.
So that 55 minutes of silence in the Pleasance.
Yeah.
Let's talk about, for someone for whom, like, charisma and joie de vivre are your kind of stock in trade, you know, you're fun, you're upbeat. If it isn't
these
working...
These are all words that make me bristle when I see them written down.
Yeah, of course
in, like,
they do. Yeah,
previews
yeah.
for gigs.
Solid.
Yeah. Charming and cheeky.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah. The nature, I'm not saying that's all you have to offer,
yeah.
but that is clearly the nature that's of your yeah. relationship with an audience. A bit like me, you know, I bristle in a similar kind of
exactly.
way, but it is, that's the language through which you're speaking to them.
Yeah.
So when it's going badly, when you're having an absolute memorable for the rest of your life
yeah.
death,
yeah.
what can you do? What structures, what strategies do you have to kind of rekindle that relationship?
I mean, talk to them. I'd sort of go through various stages where I think 10 minutes in you're like, well, I'm just going to sell the shit out of all of this stuff. I'm really, really going to sell it because I know it's good stuff and eventually I'll get them on board. And most of the time, I think that works. But then if there's another 10 minutes and they're still not on board, you're like, right, well, I'm going to bail out of it and start trying to talk to them. And that's when you're really panicking. That's when it's proper sweaty back time. And then it's happened to me a couple of times where about 40 minutes in, I've gone, I'm just going to shout at them for not enjoying it. And that normally works, annoyingly.
Why do you think that works?
Because they know it's not going well. So people need it referencing. You can't just ignore it going badly. Like it's probably only happened two or three times in my career where I've ended up having a full meltdown and it's ended up being quite funny. It happened in New Zealand, my first solo show in New Zealand. They were just smiling at me for the whole thing. And then the last 10 minutes were just me berating them for being a terrible audience.
And there is something about breaking through like that when you get genuinely visibly angry.
Yeah.
There's something about the reality of the situation. It's like, I wonder if that's what they wanted. Is that what they weren't getting before was a sort of reality from you?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. Maybe it's that thing of if it's too rehearsed or too shiny, then people don't feel connected with it, and then eventually you get angry at them and start screaming at them and go, there he is.
Yeah, I wonder. Yeah. I wonder, because I can sometimes suffer from that. I think if I break the contract with them, because, you know, I don't want it to be this way, as it sounds like you don't want it to be this way either. I would much rather be one of those comics who can walk on, hate them,
yeah.
perform a small amount of material slowly over yeah. a long time. It's easier to write.
Yeah.
And you could do it deadpan, low energy, great. And they all love it. Oh, yeah. That'd be great. But as it is, I have to make an effort. And it's just the nature of what it is. It's yeah. like that moment when you go, okay, this is actually who I am. I'm kind of stuck with me. I find if I then bristle, if I get visibly angry with something, if someone heckles me and it lands wrong, my response sounds bitchy. You can see the audience all do handbags like, like that, because I've broken the contract with
them.
I just wonder if there's a way to prevent that ever happening again. You know, maybe what it is I'm glad-handing too much.
Yeah. I feel like I'm slightly coming out the other side of that now. It's that thing I was saying earlier of I have to not care. So I think some of my stuff's a little bit harsher now, and I'm a little bit higher status than I used to be. I think I can get away with more and say quite harsh things. And still, I've still got to do a cheeky smile after it, Stu.
And are the harsh things that you're saying because you believe in the truth of those things, or is it because you're learning that that gets the biggest laugh when a nice man says something nasty?
No, I think it's just closer and closer to who I am as a person. Like, I'm a nice guy, I think.
It's difficult to say that,
but,
isn't it?
So, yeah, it is. But I've certainly got more of an edge than I ever used to present on stage. Like, first few years of doing comedy, I think when you just want it to go well, you're just like, oh, hi guys, please, please laugh at everything I'm saying. Whereas now, I think I'm much better if I go on and thinking, no, I know this is all funny, and if you guys want to get on board, you're perfectly welcome to, but if you don't, I'm going to shout at you until you do.
So what are some of the things that you took, if you could think of one quality or one piece of learning that you took from the double act with Ian that you then took with you into your own stand-up practice, what would that be?
I mean, it's probably just his working practice of just having a bit more confidence in ideas when you think of them to actually, put them into fruition. Because I think if you have an idea, you've then got to explore it rather than going, well, it's probably not good enough because I've come up with it. I think that's sometimes how I feel about stuff. And it's an active thing to push that down. I think you just need to learn to go, well, I've come up with that idea, and then any voices of self-doubt, for now, you may as well push them away and see where the idea goes. I think that's probably what I took from working with him, certainly. And also, always take the label off a bottle of water when you take it on stage. He's got a lot of sort of quite old-school pro things. He was like, never, like northern club comic things, never, always take the label off a bottle of water. Just looks unprofessional to have Evian on your bottle. It's weird, isn't it?
Sponsorship. Very nice. So let's talk a bit about Mock the Week. Mm-hmm. How many times have you done Mock now?
11.
Okay. And that is a healthy number of appearances.
Yeah. The first one went well, I think. Well enough for them to get me in for quite a few more.
Yeah. And as someone who doesn't do political material, do you do topical material? Was it a stretch to get yourself into a Mock the Week writing mode?
It is. I'm in the rhythm of it now, so it's better now. I feel across everything that's happening at the moment, but certainly in those fallow periods between series, I don't necessarily keep up with the news as much as I should do. So when it comes to doing the first episode back, I'm like, oh god, here we go. I better revise 6 months of news. Who is the Prime Minister? But the sort of show that Mock is, not everyone on there is a political or topical comic, because there's so many angles to come at it from, and everyone has their own thing in the way of covering the events. I mean, I'm doing it with Acaster the last couple of weeks, and zero politics, just all stupid stories and just trying to take it down weird tracks and stuff like that. So,
and how do you feel, what do you feel your role is on any given panel, if you're on that panel, if you're on the cast of that episode, how do you fit into the group dynamic of the show? Like, what do you bring to it that's particularly you?
I'm certainly more topical than someone like James, but probably not as topical as someone like Nish, who was also on it last week. I tend to keep it based in the topical stuff, but it'll always be the silliest take on something, or just the rudest take. Nish refers to my comedy as blue whimsy. So there's certainly a whimsical element to it. It's not straight out filth, but a dick will always pop up at some point. And I feel like that's what I sort of do on Mock the Week as well. The scenes we'd like to see are just an absolute playground for blue whimsy.
Have your appearances always been within the kind of like the current phase of Mock the Week, whereby it's the less stressed, less combative, less competitive.
Yeah, so it definitely, my first episode was Rob Beckett, Sarah Pascoe, Ramesh, and then Hugh and Ed Byrne, I think. So it was a very, like, friends, just like actual friends.
Yeah, I was
going to say,
apart
friends.
From Ed and Hugh, that's actual mates that you'd go to the pub with, sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And then Ed and Hugh are so friendly and so welcoming that it's fine. And then Dara loves the new form of it as well, I think. He just likes to see it evolve.
And do you ever worry that will trip you up? In that, like, in the old days of Mock the Week, you'd want to turn up with like 1,000 jokes in your back pocket, like strapped for war.
Yeah.
Whereas now you're a bit more inclined to turn up and go, hey, friends. And then
I still get that little panic where I go, like, if this goes badly, they could drop me. So I'm gonna come armed to the back teeth, but hoping that I don't have to use most of it, because we'll just end up having a really fun chat. I mean, being on with friends is difficult as well, because you get too giddy. So last week, the producers came to me, Nish and James individually, and told us we had to just calm down a bit. And if Dara told us he wanted to stop messing around, we should stop messing around.
Because the three of you are just pricking
about.
You get
too excited. But quite often it's Dara leading that. He loves it. He gets so excited. But then eventually you'll just tip him over the edge and just see him just hold his hands up. You're like, we could better stop. Dad's angry.
So do you still work? I don't know what the current system is for writing for Mock. I know in the past you kind of get assigned a writer.
No, I do work with people on it. I tend to work with one person per episode, but you're not assigned. I just...
Okay.
So Tom Neenan, I work with him. He's a brilliant writer. It's people I know who are good at stuff.
And talk to me about that kind of writing with process, because that's something that years ago that felt like no one would ever mention, that you would write with someone, because it seemed like cheating, or you'd be worried that
it's just there's so much
grown-up comics would catch you out, you know?
There's so much stuff, and it's just this crazy, like, day before where you just get all of these stories through, and it's just useful to have someone to field your ideas with, just to get them out loud, really. It's like when we write together, it's that sort of vibe where you're just putting ideas across, and even just saying them out loud to someone else, you can see by what direction their eyebrows go in that you're like, no, that's a terrible idea. You're right. Because I never say stuff out loud otherwise. Like, even stand-up, the first time I say it out loud will be on stage, and I'll get halfway through a joke and go, who came up with this shit? Why did I ever think this would be funny?
Is that true that you don't take on stage something that you might have said conversationally?
Sometimes conversationally, but quite often it's just something I've scribbled down in a book, and then I'll say it out loud and go, I have absolutely no idea why I ever thought this would be funny.
And do you have particular ways of attacking a subject to try and find the funny in it that you feel? Do you notice yourself relying on a particular... I don't know, maybe relying is the wrong word, but when you attack a subject, is there like a process that you will go through? Like, let's pick something.
Yeah.
What have you got cooking at the moment for your Edinburgh show? I know you're going to want to say absolutely nothing.
No.
I know that's not true.
There's stuff.
So what at the moment is your most confident routine from the forthcoming show?
I've got a story about a sports massage.
Okay.
Which is the thing that's working best at the moment.
It's originated with a true story of something that happened to you.
Yeah, it is.
So talk to us about the development of that from it happening... Exactly, like from it happening to now, and what you've done with it and how you've changed it.
Well, initially, I just had the basis of the story that I went for a sports massage and I farted during the sports massage. That's all I had. And I mean, obviously that's just funny. It's just one layer of fun, isn't it? It's like, because, you know, farts are funny, Stu. So I just had to walk on stage and say that had happened. It got the initial laugh of interest. Like, it wasn't just deathly silent and people laughed and as if to say, carry on, please tell us more.
Yeah, right. That's important, listening to that instinct, like the laugh, which is effectively, permission to explore further.
Yeah. And then I'll just start talking about that. I'll just mainly come up with it on stage. I probably have two or three jokes that I know I can go to that I've written, But the rest of it is just talking on stage and see what comes out, really.
So you're doing that thing of going, right, I'm going to start with this subject. I know where it can go 2 minutes from now.
Yeah.
I'm going to challenge myself to fill the 2 minutes see and see happens. If anything else comes out.
Yeah.
And is that the way you've always written?
Yeah, I would have thought by now I'd be in a situation where I can sit down, come up with something from scratch and go, I know this is going to work because I know what I'm like and I know what I can talk about. But there's still a heavy element of being absolutely in the dark until I say it on stage. It's weird, isn't it? I thought I could write a full solid routine now before I've performed it and then go on. But no, it's always go on. They give the laugh of, please continue. And I go, oh, how exciting. I found a bit.
Yeah, I feel the same. I feel like, yeah. I mean, like I've got a routine in my new show about escape rooms, which I know you're a huge fan of.
I love it. And I've heard you've got a routine on escape rooms and I'm so angry.
Yes, good. That's
because obviously I planned, I was like, right, well, I'll write that in my notebook. Escape rooms, I do those, so I'll do a routine on those. And I just didn't get to it quick enough.
Yes, do you know what? I've got one punchline about me and my brother going to an escape room and forgetting to pay and then going back. But do we go back? Because we had escaped.
Yeah.
Like that, basically, yeah, that's just, that was enough to go, oh, the permission to laugh. Yeah, oh, yeah, right, I can get somewhere in it. And then often I find the jokes in the middle, now you know that there's an end in sight, the jokes in the middle then get better than the end. And then I end up in the position of going, well, you know from when we've written together, I'm like, the end is no longer good enough because the joke's in the middle of the good bit.
Yeah.
Then you've got to throw the end away. And you're like, no, it's got to end somewhere.
That's my favourite bit of writing is when you know the idea's funny, you know what the end is, and adding
definitely
stuff. Just
definitely
adding stuff. So great. But and I think I am occasionally guilty of just adding far too much.
Okay.
I am awful at streamlining a routine. Like, I'll hang so much on
Well,
stuff.
This is it. I referred to this earlier on. You're very, very good at tagging. You're very good at going, that's the basic idea, and then explore, unpack more stuff. Now, that to me feels like a sit down and write it process. Or is it more of a pulling it apart on stage process?
It's more of adding little bits every single time. So if I can challenge myself to do a new, even like just one new sentence in a story at every gig, then I end up with a sizable chunk on.
And do you, because I think one of the questions about you as a comic for me is, not the questions of whether you deserve to be one. one of the curious things about you is that for all that you claim to bumble through and it's luck and, you know, all the rest of it, you're clearly capable of the self-discipline required to change from a fat man to a very thin man.
Right, yeah.
So there is something there. You have got some kind of iron in you. And I'm fascinated by self-discipline because I'll think to myself, right, no more biscuits ever.
Yeah.
And in the next biscuit I see, I'll go, well, obviously I'm having that. Yeah. And it's just gone out the window, right?
Yeah, sure.
So talk to me about self-discipline as it pertains to your life and to your writing.
I don't think I'm as self-disciplined with my writing as I have been with my health. Because I think quite often I'll use health stuff as an excuse for filling a day.
Okay, that's interesting.
So if I wake up in the morning and go for a run, I'll be like, well done, mate. You've absolutely smashed today. Netflix for the rest of the day. Thank you. Little treat. And I need to find that. Quite often I need structure. So having an entire year to write a show is a nightmare for me.
Yeah.
Because the first like 4 months are nothing, because I can think, well, I've got loads more time after that. Whereas something like Mot the Week, I've got 2 days or whatever to get some stuff together. I've got a deadline. I will work to it. Sometimes I think I shouldn't be in a creative industry. I should be a lawyer or something like that, or just in the army, where someone's told me what to do and I will happily do it. Because I find that a beautiful feeling when someone's told you to do something and then you do it. I like it.
You almost need to employ someone to be your boss as a comedian?
Yes.
Yes. That's like a good idea.
Yeah. I need a comedian boss.
Yeah, I'm just briefly just pausing to think about the efficacy of that. I've thought that in the past, that if you could... A deadline is great, right? But you can't impose the deadline yourself because then it's not a deadline.
I've heard of people who've got directors for shows where the director says, I want that show fully typed out by February and sent to me. And then we start working on it.
Who the fuck says that?
I know who it is. I mean, apparently.
Okay.
You know, Dec Munro.
Yes.
Says that's like Sophie and Ian Smith.
Yeah.
Says, I want a full script. That may be, you know, that.
I mean, a lot of what you hear on the circuit is absolute bullshit, stuff like that. But that could be true.
I mean, obviously, that's terrifying. But I think that sort of thing would work for
that
you.
That would work, because then you actually have to get up and do it. Yeah. And then imagine that. You've written your show in February.
Yeah. It'd be good. Or like at least a good basis of it.
So this show that you're putting together now, any cauliflower material in it?
No cauliflower material. That is a prime example of me mining one topic.
You got literally an hour out of your anger at the idea that there could be cauliflower bases for pizza.
Well, it wasn't. I mean, it was... There was a lot of cauliflower stuff.
I couldn't believe how much you reincorporated cauliflower into that show. I enjoyed the show enormously, but I was like, wait a minute, is this going where I
think
it is?
I mean, obviously when you were there, it was terrible, but I think I'd written such a long routine on cauliflower pizza and sort of new health fads that it was weird that it was just sat in the middle of the show, like that I was talking about other stuff and then talking about that and then moving on. So I thought, what I'm going to do, I'm just going to have to split it and then just weave everything else into it. And then keep claiming the show's not about cauliflower, but keep going back to cauliflower, which made me laugh so much, but really got on some reviewers, nads.
And are you able then, we must wrap up, are you able to continue to consistently fulfill this idea of getting yourself in a creative space by not giving a fuck what they think, like they being the audience?
Yeah.
Can you do that when reviewers are in?
I am not told when reviewers are in, and I never wish to know when reviewers are in, when reviews come out. Occasionally, I will recognize a reviewer. So last year in Edinburgh, I was on the stage as the audience came in. Not when you saw it, though, I think, because you saw it quite early. And the stage was very high in the room, and I felt so disconnected from them that I then decided I'll be on stage and in the room when they come in saying hello to everyone. So at least they've seen me already and there won't be that thing of me standing towering above them on a high stage. That turned out to be a mistake because then I would see people come in and on one occasion I did see a sneaky little reviewer.
And did it fuck the show up for you?
Yeah. But it was a difficult show anyway. And I think there's that initial thing of when you can always tell in Edinburgh when it's going to be a sticky one, especially if you're quite deep into the run, you know how things should be going and how things fly if it's going to be a good show. And the first few jokes were just a bit sticky. And then what I would have normally done is gone, right, we're just going to step it up, really sell it, get in amongst it. We can bring this back. But all it did in my head was like, well, that guy's there.
Yeah.
That guy's there. So he's already probably written down that the opening of the show is not very good. And then it's just everything just falls apart after that.
So we'll finish with this. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you, people of the O2, for coming along.
It's just been an hour of me saying that I'm a shit comedian. I'm also all right.
I felt like I should jump in and protect you then, but I also thought that'd be a great place to give me an opportunity to end the show. Which single bit are you most proud of?
There's a bit that I keep coming back to, which I should have dropped by now, but I'd bring it out for difficult gigs because I still enjoy doing it. And it is a bit about me going to have my nether regions looked at the doctors. And it was a female doctor and she tells me to pop it out. And then after that, I've got a big thing about saying, well, that's nice because it suggests quite a small penis. It's better than me going in there and her saying, okay, just heave it out your trousers. And then I've got about 10 tags of different things about me, like lassoing it and getting a Shire horse to drag it over. And that's just a joy to perform. Especially when they're not on board and I'm like got 11 to go. Like, you better strap in, guys. Because it ends up with like the seven dwarves carrying it on. And I get to refer to it as my meat. You know, it's...
This is a perfect place to leave things. It's a very well-written, very well-explored, very articulate dick joke.
Yes, Blue Whimsy.
Blue Whimsy. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Ed Gamble. So that was Ed. Thank you very much to him for coming along and being on the show. Thank you to Georgie Donnelly for sorting out the booking at the Stone Free Festival. Thanks to Rainbow. Thank you very much for listening and being part of it. You can donate, of course, at comedianscomedian.com/donate or /merch if you would like to feast your peepers on that wonderful new T-shirt.
So that's that. I'm going to stick around for a little post-amble in just a second, but that officially... Oh, no, it doesn't quite conclude the podcast. Let me just remind you, if you'd like to get in touch, at ComComPod, or indeed at Stu Goldsmith, my extremely well... produced and content-heavy Twitter feeds, or you can go to, you can email me at info@comedianscomedian.com, and if you want to be a cool guy and let me reply to you with a brief reply and know in your heart that I have actually bothered reading your email, you can put PS, I'm a cool guy. And people do that, and I'm very much appreciative of it. So that is that for now. I'll speak to you next week. Oh, who shall we have? We've got so many great ones. I've got like 8 episodes in the can. They're great. So we'll just have to see who we use. Speak to you soon. So this is, I mean, this is a frustrating one. I did a whole post-amble. I did a good 12-minute post-amble, and I sent all the files to hashtag ThanksDaryl, and they were deleted somehow. Not by him. I mean, they basically didn't send, and then I deleted them somehow. I just deleted them. And now I've got to redo them, and it's late, and I've got to get up in 6 hours, and I'm not in bed yet. So... what was I going to chat to you about? I had a nice little thing about the wedding, the conclusion of the wedding. Everyone, not everyone, men with their tops off. Several large men with their tops off, myself included. And our friends Tom and Ben hoisted us aloft on their shoulders. And me and Mrs. ComCom, she didn't have her top off. No girls do. I do feel sorry for girls in that you are not able to participate in a right royal tops off without them sort of being some kind of agenda, perceptual or otherwise. So we had a bit of LCD sound system at the crowning achievement of the sort of wedding disco. And she loves LCD sound system, and I love taking my top off. So it was really wonderful. Thank you to everyone that came, and thanks to all of you who sent me nice messages about it. I very much appreciate those. Hell Week has been great. It's been great, even when the show hasn't... I mean, there's been small numbers, small but perfectly formed audiences. Difficult to really sense momentum in a room with small numbers, but... I've just enjoyed every minute of the show. I said on Facebook this morning, you know that expression, kill your darlings, you know, you kill your babies, whatever it is, where you, what it means is any material to which you become sentimentally attached, even if you are, and it has to go, it has to go. Doesn't matter if you're attached to it, it goes. So that is, it was the morning of the long knives this morning. I got rid of so much stuff that I love and binned it, and the show is still overrunning. I'm not gloating here. The stuff that's in there is not... completely ready yet, but it's very exciting to go, that bit's perfectly good, and I like it. I like doing it, and it's funny, and it's evocative, but it doesn't need to be in this show. I could pop that in my back pocket. So it feels... I suppose I had a meeting with my friend Steve this morning, and we realised in the first 10 minutes of the meeting, it was a little kind of writing chat, we realised what I needed from Steve was for him to tell me to hold my nerve, because I've got to a stage with this new show where I'm like, this is a bit different what I'm doing. I sort of spotted myself in the process. I spotted myself doing what I'd usually do to some material, and I thought, that's a bit boring. You've got a system. Why just adhere to the system? Why not try and actually... maybe be a bit less all-encompassing, maybe be slightly not divisive in terms of opinion, but you know what I mean? Why not really pursue the stuff that is making you yourself, Stu, really laugh? And maybe that's at the expense of taking every single member of the audience with you. I mean, this will come as music to the ears of anyone who in the past has gone, come on, push yourself. I'm pushing myself, but as a result, I had a little moment with Steve where I was like, I mean, there's still time to pull back, right? I could just do what I normally do, and I'd be happy. You know, I like my work, so maybe it would be fine to just do more of it. But I think it's a more interesting direction. Time will tell. Time will tell. So I'm off to bed now because it's late and I've got to get up very soon with the little guy. And then we're going to go to Glastonbury Festival. So if you're at Glastonbury, come and say hi. I bumped into my friend John earlier on today, who was kind enough to come to Hell Week. He is someone who has been watching me at Glastonbury since before I was a comic. He used to come and see me do street shows, him and his family. And now they come, and then the last few years, they've been coming to see me in the cabaret tent. And lovely, John, to see you at the Hell Week shows. I'm very much looking forward to seeing all of the Glastow family, the extended family now that my family is bigger by a factor of a wife, and really excited to be there. I think
this year is going to be the first one I'm going to where the plan is to go there and spend family time there, rather than the plan being to go there and run around with my head in my pants and hang out with a bunch of executive carnies. No, what I want to do this time is I'm really going to try so hard to do this. I'll report back next week on whether I managed it. I very much want to get up, like go to bed early by Glastonbury standards, midnight, having not drunk myself into oblivion, and then get up with the boy at 6, pop him in the papoose, and go for a wander and go and look at some feckless dregs and point out the feckless dregs. I just want to kind of wander around the place. I think there must be a whole world to that festival, which I know, I feel like I know inside out. I've been so many times. It's where me and Mrs. Comcom met. And I'm really looking forward to seeing it afresh, wandering around it, checking out all the great stuff in the kids' field and just enjoying it. The Boutros loves music. So I really hope he loves it, and I really hope that we don't all evaporate in this sweltering heat. That'll do me for now. I'm rambling inconsequentially, more so than usual. Do I always say that? It's conceivable. Thank you for listening, if you have. Thank you very much for your kind attention, and even in that final sentence, I'm continuing to ramble, which must mean it's time for bed. Good night, everyone. Unless you're driving. Speak to you soon.